From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Republicans are pushing an annual day to honor the late conservative activist Charlie Kirk.
What he was doing while he was assassinated is the reason that we should have a day of remembrance.
Also this week, while President Trump is urging states to not regulate AI, Florida is moving forward with some attempt at putting guardrails on the technology.
This is a balance between making sure that we are still leading the way on tech, but also laying a foundation and protecting our consumers.
We'll also learn what might really happen if Congress doesn't act to extend Affordable Care Act tax credits, and we'll get the latest on the plight of the Florida Panther. I'm Tom Flanagan, online and on air. This is Capitol Report and our weekly wrap-up of top stories from the 2026 lawmaking session in Tallahassee.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org.
Republican lawmakers are pushing ahead with proposed legislation that would create a Charlie Kirk Day of Remembrance in Florida. Gina Jordan reports two versions of the bill passed House and Senate committees this week along party lines.
Kirk was co-founder and executive director of Turning Point USA, a nonprofit that promotes conservative policies. He was shot to death in September during an appearance at Utah Valley University.
Charlie Kirk made a national impact by encouraging young Americans to think critically, engage in civic life, and stand up for constitutional freedoms. He inspired millions to participate in public dialogue, defend their beliefs respectfully, and understand their rights and responsibilities as citizens.
Fort Myers Republican Senator Jonathan Martin is sponsoring the bill that would designate October 14th, Kirk's birthday, as an annual day of remembrance. Addressing the Senate Education Post-Secondary Committee, Martin cited the kind of debate that Kirk often engaged in with college students, including at the time of his death.
What he was doing while he was assassinated is the reason that we should have a day of remembrance.
The bill drew deep disagreement from the two Democrats on the panel. It turns out Charlie Kirk shared a birthday with George Floyd. Floyd's public arrest and suffocation by a Minneapolis police officer in 2020 sparked nationwide protests and the Black Lives Matter movement. So Miami Gardens Democratic Senator Chevron Jones offered an amendment to the bill to also designate October 14th as a remembrance for George Floyd.
It is about acknowledging moments that force a nation to confront itself. History does not only remember the flawless. History remembers events that change the course of public conscience.
The amendment was voted down, but Martin offered to talk more about it later with Jones. Senate Minority Leader Lori Berman of Boca Raton wondered why Kirk should get such recognition.
We're going to put into statute a day of remembrance for someone who's been, you know, talks about who's done things that have been very bigoted and racist and misogynist, and I really can't support anything that anyone who sends those kinds of messages. And I find it really troubling, as Senator Jones said, that we are even having this discussion.
Tallahassee Republican Senator Corey Simon, a Black lawmaker, praised Kirk's efforts to have a dialogue about divisive subjects.
Far too often, that speech has been stifled on our campuses and around our country. And that does not lead to progress. When one side or the other has to sit back and be quiet because what they may think or feel, regardless of if we agree or disagree, is seen as hateful or seen as despicable or seen as just different.
The discussion that we're having here today is not whether or not we could have or should have political discourse. It's when does that discourse become degrading, discriminatory, and when it also become divisive.
Jones, who is also Black and is openly gay, got heated as he went on in debate of the bill.
And I'm appalled that we can sit here and legitimize an individual that would not, and could not care less about whether or not I have this seat and anybody else who look like me the same. My disagreement is not about the Day of Remembrance. It's about what we're putting the stamp of approval on.
Martin had the last word as he closed on his bill. He told Jones and Berman that he would probably feel like they do if he had not seen the full context of Kirk's comments.
They were asking him questions. How do you feel about affirmative action? How do you feel about DEI? And I saw that back and forth. And when you see the faces of the people who are asking those questions and engaging Charlie Kirk in that dialogue, you know for a fact, Charlie was not being racist. Charlie was addressing tough conversations with individuals who had never been spoken to with truth.
The bill passed the committee alongside a similar version in the House. It would put the Kirk remembrance into state law, but it would not create a state holiday. I'm Gina Jordan.
Only the second week of the Florida legislative session for 2026, and already a lot of stuff going on. Let's see, artificial intelligence, that has got to be a biggie. And so our Capitol reporter, Tristan Wood, has been following the bills that are connected with that issue, amongst many other things. But let's start with that, Tristan. What was on the table for AI the first couple days?
So two big AI bills were heard in their first committee meetings in Tallahassee that have been really driving this conversation. The first of them being the AI Bill of Rights proposal that has been championed by Governor Ron DeSantis. And the other one would bring a whole host of state regulations on the construction of AI data centers.
Okay, well, as soon as you say Bill of Rights, that seems to give whatever follows it some real gravitas, and it must be something important. So talk about that. What is this AI Bill of Rights thing?
This Bill of Rights that DeSantis is championing would require, among other things, disclosure to consumers that they're interacting with AI systems when they do so, require AI companies to de-identify user data before they sell it or distribute it, prohibit unauthorized name, image, and likeness use, and require parental consent before minors can interact with chatbots, and also require that records of minor interactions with chatbots be kept for their parents to be able to review. Now, the governor has pushed for this heavily, and it's really been picking up momentum in Florida. During public comment on the bill, though, it got a lot of support, but it also got some criticism. Rich Templin with the AFL-CIO says he'd like to see more protections for workers included in a AI Bill of Rights instead of just consumer protections.
We see it as the next industrial revolution. And we want to make sure that there is a regulatory framework in place to take care of the workers. This is a great consumer protection beginning, but what about workers?
And it's seemingly overall a winning issue for voters. Pew and other pollsters have found a large chunk of Americans across party lines want to see some type of protections for consumers regarding AI.
Okay, but I heard that President Trump put out this executive order attempting to preempt AI regulation from the states, including Florida. What's up with that?
He put out an executive order on December 11th where he said that he wants to restrict state-level AI regulation, like you said, by curbing what he termed onerous and excessive state laws. It's worth noting that before he put out this order, California and Colorado and other states have passed their own AI regulations already that are already on the books. Now, St. Augustine Republican Representative Tom Leake, who's kind of carrying this AI Bill of Rights package, said in committee that he doesn't think this bill is onerous or excessive. And he did say he thinks national rules should come from Congress, but that the state needs to act to provide immediate protections and not wait for Congress to act.
That relies on Congress to act, which I don't have a great deal of faith in right now, at least not to act quickly. And I think the protections that we've got here for minors and for vulnerable adults and for all of us, really, are in line with what President Trump wants.
But there are still questions about whether this order from Trump is even legally binding. It's unclear if the president of the United States even has the legal power to restrict those types of regulation passed at the state level.
All right. Well, that may be open to debate, but there's something else that
I'm sure is going to be a major controversial issue too, and that regards data centers that have been getting an awful, awful lot of national publicity of late, especially in places like Virginia, where they're just popping up like mushrooms after the rain.
This bill primarily addresses a lot of the electric and water use concerns that have emerged, because those are the two areas where the ecological impacts of these data centers have really been captured popular attention, that and the carbon emissions for them when they're on the generators that some of them have had. Now, this bill would enact requirements for large data center water use permits and require the Florida Public Service Commission to develop tariffs and rate structures to make sure companies that own the data centers foot the bill for the energy use and not on other consumers that are around the area. Hialeah Gardens Republican Senator Brian Avila says it's trying to strike a balance between protecting local communities while not turning away economic investment from these data centers.
This is a balance between making sure that we are still leading the way on tech, but also laying a foundation and protecting our consumers.
So what kind of response is this bill picking up in committee, Tristan?
So during public comment on the bill, some groups spoke in favor of it, like Heaven Campbell with Solar United Neighbors Action, saying it was essentially a bipartisan issue. But some pro-business groups had signaled that they, you know, are in favor of some type of regulations. But Adam Basford with Associated Industries of Florida during committee said that protections are needed, but he thinks that changes need to come to the bill to not dissuade that type of tech investment.
If the U.S. is going to continue to compete globally in artificial intelligence and advanced computing, states like Florida must be able to build infrastructure that makes that possible.
Now, both these bills are only in their first committee stop, so a lot could change here. Amendments could come, they could stall in their committee and not get passed at all. But whatever ends up happening, I'll be guiding you, Tom, and all our listeners through it, through this legislative session.
I will be eagerly awaiting those reports. Thanks so much, Tristan Wood, our Capitol reporter here on Capitol Report.
Nice chatting, Tom.
Coming up on Capitol Report, what happens when tax credits run out for folks on the Affordable Care Act marketplace?
Where did they cut costs? Where did they tighten their belts because of the increase in premiums and the cost of health care?
Some mainstream religious groups have been trying to persuade Florida lawmakers to back off the state's support for what they consider federal overreach on immigration.
People have lost their trust in local law enforcement. That means crime is harder to solve.
It's hard to make good decisions if good information isn't available to guide them. That pretty much sums up the current situation with how many people really need the food provided by SNAP benefits.
People are always looking for information about need and how that might change over time.
And despite the best efforts of conservationists and others, the Florida panther is in worse shape than ever. Millions of Americans may no longer be able to afford health insurance if Congress fails to extend Affordable Care Act enhanced premium tax credits by January 30th. To find out what comes next for Floridians, WGCU's Jennifer Crawford spoke with Benga Ajilore, chief economist for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
More than 20 million people who enrolled in ACA-related health insurance relied heavily on these subsidies. What is the fallout from the subsidies expiring?
Their premiums are going to jump up upwards of at least 50% for a lot of people, even more for elderly people.
The subsidies, or premium tax credits, began in 2021 to help Americans get through the pandemic. Why have so many people now relied on these subsidies?
One of the things is that healthcare coverage is expensive, and one of the things that's going to be important for people is to be able to afford them is the premium tax credit enhancements. And so, you know, healthcare coverage will keep going up, but one of the things is that these subsidies have been made it helpful for them, and it's going to be difficult for them to afford it.
In Florida, nearly 5 million seniors get their insurance plans through the Affordable Care Act, and some are on fixed incomes. What does this mean for those seniors in particular who need the subsidies to be able to afford health care?
The biggest thing is that they're going to have to keep on the coverage, and so it's going to make it more expensive. So then the question is, what do they have to give up now that the coverage has become more expensive? What's going to happen with housing? What's going to happen with food? We're in a period of where we're seeing higher prices for a lot of goods like energy, groceries, things like that. So the question is, what are these seniors going to have to give up in order to continue their health care coverage?
Tough questions. Now, recent reports estimate over 4.5 million Americans will simply forego health insurance altogether. What impact does that have on the health insurance marketplace altogether?
So what that's going to do is increase premiums for all of us. You know, the way we keep premiums down is by having people who are both healthy and people who need health coverage to be able to have health insurance. The other thing that, you know, doesn't get talked a lot about is that people who still don't have health insurance, when they need it, are still going to use the healthcare coverage. And this is going to have huge impact for rural hospitals, because having coverage is what makes these hospitals financially viable. So now that people are going to drop off, premiums are going to go up, hospitals are going to have to bear more of the cost, and it's going to make everyone struggle.
And what about small businesses who use ACA-related insurance to help cover their workers? Is there any option for business owners who want to provide health insurance for their employees?
I think this is the same story that we talked about with seniors, that they're going to have to make a decision. They want to provide it for the employees. A lot of self-employed workers have it. If they continue to purchase it, where are the costs going to go? How are they going to shift costs? Part of it is like, okay, I want to keep it for my employees, but now my costs are going to go up. Do they have to now let people go in order to maintain their costs? Because at the same time, small businesses are struggling these days.
And what is the wider impact of the loss of these subsidies on the overall cost of health care and private insurance for everyone else?
So because people are going to drop out, we talked about, you know, 4 million people may drop out. At the same time, we have to look at the broader context where we have with Medicaid, people are going to be dropping their coverage because they're going to get kicked off due to eligibility concerns. And so what's going to happen now is that premiums for people who have private insurance, people have it through other means, are going to have to pay higher premiums. And again, we have to look at the broader context where we have inflation, you know, going up, you know, 2.7%, that costs are going up. And so people are going to start have to make decisions about where did they cut costs, where did they tighten their belts because of the increase in premiums and the cost of health care.
Now, Congress took part in the longest government shutdown in history to try to preserve the tax credits. Do you see a path forward that includes the subsidies being restored at any point?
I would hope so. And I think this is where, you know, individuals can, you know, talk about advocacy, talk about why health coverage is important for them and what's going to happen for them. And so letting Congress know this is important for us to be able to maintain costs. A lot of people are worried about affordability. Congress is going to have to extend their budget past January 30th this year. This is an opportunity for them to replace the subsidies and keep costs low for health coverage.
And what do you think the future of the Affordable Care Act looks like? Is there hope?
I like to be optimistic, and I think there's always hope. This is what Congress does, and we've seen what this means for people, especially seniors, small business owners, self-employed workers, that this has been really helpful, keeping costs low, and most importantly, helping people maintain coverage. When you have coverage, you're more likely to take care of yourself and not wait till there's something's more serious. And so I think there's always going to be hope with the Affordable Care Act because we've seen how well it's worked for the American public.
That was Benga Ajilore, chief economist for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, speaking with WGCU's Jennifer Crawford. It wouldn't be a Florida legislative session without a seemingly endless parade of special days, demonstrations, and exhibits all over the Capitol building. Among them this week was a somber display of faces.
These are three persons who died in detention in Florida over the past year. There's actually many more. We have a larger display, almost 50 pictures of people who've died in detention across the country over the last year.
The man speaking is Russell Myers. He's the executive director of the Florida Council of Churches. Standing beside Myers was David Williamson. He's with the Florida Conference of the United Methodist Church.
So we are inviting people to hold these signs to make people aware of the human rights abuses that are going on in the detention camps in the Everglades. as well as the violation of civil rights with regard to due process.
Williamson says the purpose of this exhibit goes beyond simple awareness. There's a very specific ask for Florida lawmakers.
We want to close those camps, not replicate that model, and we're also asking our lawmakers to stop requiring our police, our sheriffs, and our state police to collaborate with ICE, knowing that their responsibilities are to serve and protect our communities, not to do the job of immigration and customs law enforcement.
For those who might claim that this exhibit is anti-law enforcement, Myers insists just the opposite is true.
There's actually been thousands of people picked up in Florida. We don't hear about it the way we're hearing about actions taken in other places. But what is happening in communities is that people have lost their trust in local law enforcement. That means crime is harder to solve. It means people will not participate with the kinds of social processes that make a community safe.
And this is just one example of how, this year in particular, national issues are very much connected to what is going on in the busy halls of the Florida Capitol. Federal lawmakers cut billions from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, last year. The Trump administration also stopped producing an annual hunger survey. Now it will be harder to keep track of those who can't afford groceries. WUSF's Gabriella Paul talked with food policy researcher Elaine Waxman about the fallout of missing data.
We've been very fortunate in the United States to have an annual national survey on food security. In September, it became known that the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which has published these reports annually, had decided to discontinue that data collection.
Could you put a finer point on just how much this data gets used and what it means for it to be potentially not there anymore?
Well, for example, the federal government has given grants in the past to encourage more purchases of fruits and vegetables with SNAP. And in virtually every one of those grant applications is a statement of the food insecurity estimates for the local area to make the case for why they should get a grant. States also use it to understand where resources need to be deployed and how things are moving overall based on economic conditions or changes in policy. Service providers lean on it really heavily because they have limited resources. So am I going to put a mobile food pantry in this community or that community, right? People are always looking for information about need and how that might change over time.
Can you just respond to the memo about this survey that called it redundant and costly as a justification for eliminating it?
It's my understanding that the administration was paying roughly $1.3 million to the Census Bureau to field these questions every year. That's a fairly nominal amount. That's not a big cost saver. And arguably, it's a very big opportunity cost to remove it. You can't really make up for the scale of the federal government in reaching a large number of households. But in addition, it was useful to have food security questions embedded in some of the other national surveys. That's not redundancy. That's thoughtful use of research to understand, for example, the intersection between food insecurity and health. Through these surveys over the years, we've learned that food insecurity is associated with higher rates of diabetes, higher rates of cardiovascular disease, cognitive delays in children. You know, those are major public health considerations.
This data, it's also been a good benchmark on the effectiveness of SNAP. Are we going to be able to monitor the impact of the billions in cuts coming to the program starting this year?
No, we lose visibility for understanding what happens as a result of food assistance program choices. And that's been really critical during the Great Recession. We had a very big spike in food insecurity. We were also able to use the food insecurity trends to see what happened during COVID. We had a big spike initially, but then miraculously, we held it flat because we had a quick response by the federal government and also by the charitable sector. We have huge changes coming in SNAP, coming in Medicaid, and a number of other programs. We are not going to be able to monitor
And that's where the loss of data, the loss of trust in data is so concerning, because ultimately it affects everybody. It's not a researcher issue. Taking data away is also eroding democratic participation.
If the numbers aren't there, there's perceivably not a counterpoint to any president saying what is true.
Right. And if you don't measure something, particularly in our modern world, it's easy to say it doesn't exist.
That was WUSF's Gabriella Paul speaking with Elaine Waxman of the Urban Institute about the loss of food security data. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, conservation groups notified the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and others this week of an intent to file a federal lawsuit. They're trying to protect endangered Florida panthers from a massive new development within the panthers' occupied breeding habitat in southwest Florida. More on that story from WGCU's Mike Braun.
Jason Tatoy, Florida Policy Director and a senior attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity, says the Fish and Wildlife Service never should have authorized the project in question, Rural Lands West Development in Collier County, without first analyzing its effects on the panther's ability to recover.
It's an over 10,000-acre footprint. And what's really problematic about it is how the U.S. government went about reviewing this project and likely more to come, and its impacts to the Florida panther. They just simply ignored how this type of project would impact the ability for the species to recover.
The latest science shows right now that the species is essentially treading water, and the population may actually be decreasing.
That's really a problem when a species is just kind of clinging to survival, and what the whole purpose of the Endangered Species Act is to get it off the list.
Despite helpful things like the wildlife corridor, the deck is being stacked against the panthers.
It's a race against the clock. And I like to kind of just try to explain to people is the wildlife corridor is critical, but it's habitat that was always there. It's changing ownership. It's being put in protection, but we're not creating new habitat. There's a finite amount of habitat left.
He says that around 8 million acres is needed for panthers to continue living, and even in the best of years, only 100,000 acres get preserved.
I have hope for the corridor and for the panther, but what I'm very concerned about right now is what this cursory type of review for projects like this is very troubling. Is the panther in jeopardy right now? If it's not, then what is that tipping point? Those are the questions we asked and that they never answered in these reviews. And this is a practice that just can't continue.
There is now a 60-day period before the suit can be filed, and Tatoy says Fish and Wildlife has been asked to reinitiate consultation and make a good faith effort to reconsider. This is Mike Braun.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Jennifer Crawford, Gabriella Paul, and Mike Brown. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again next week, online and on air, for more reports from the state capitol.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.